Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for November the 12th. Coming up on this week's podcast, the theoretical physicist Dr. Michio Kaku gives us his vision of the future and tells us why we're about to move from the age of discovery to the age of mastery. Also in the show, we'll talk robotic cars and synthesized voices. And we're putting on the Brut cologne and disco shirts to explain how you fall in love at first sight. Plus, a brand new planet, understanding obesity genes, and probably a bit on this new thing called the iPhone or phone or something. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. The Science Weekly pod squad is literally chomping at the bit to unleash themselves on you this week. In ascending order of aggression, it's the Guardian's tech correspondent, Big Bad Bobby Johnson. See? Not very angry at all. Rotten to the core, it's Ian Sample, one of the Guardian's science correspondents.
Hello.
And Ian's co-conspirator is the Guardian's angriest man, it's James Randerson.
Hello.
Not very angry at all, in fact. Also in the studio today is a surprise mystery guest. More from him later, but holding us all together this week and maybe even talking a little bit too is Science Weekly producer Ben Green, who today is celebrating 1 year at the helm of this magnificent show. Well done, Ben. Now, a question for you. The show is all about the future, so what do you want to do when you grow up, Ben?
When I grow up, I want to live to 150 and have a car that drives itself. I'd like to live in a virtual world and grow new bits for my body when I'm old. And be best mates with robots.
Were you on drugs for that, Ben? Anyway, that was a teaser for Visions of the Future, a new BBC Four series which explores the cutting-edge science of today, tomorrow and beyond. It's presented by Michio Kaku, a leading theoretical physicist at the City University of New York. He believes that we humans are at a turning point in our history. We're about to move from being passive observers of nature to its active choreographers. This belief forms the central argument to Visions of the Future, and when I spoke to Dr. Kaku in his office in New York, I asked him to explain more.
In just 15 years, by 2020 or so, chips will cost about a penny. And that means that billions of chips will be scattered all over the environment, in our glasses, in our clothes, in our household appliances, making things intelligent. For example, cars will drive themselves. These cars already exist. And in the program, I actually am driving one of these cars. And also, your glasses will be intelligent. You'll have full internet capability, that downloading any video or any website on your glasses. And your glasses will also recognize people's faces as well. And so you'll always know precisely who you're talking to. Medicine is going to be revolutionized. We'll swallow little aspirin pills that'll take pictures of our insides so we won't have to get a colonoscopy. Medicine will be revolutionized because we'll go to the doctor and get a CD-ROM with all our genes listed. In the program, in part two, I go to the hospital, I have my blood drawn, and they analyze my DNA for about 1,000 genetic diseases. Now, this is unprecedented. Just within the last few years, we can now get an owner's manual for your body. And then we went down to Wake Forest University in North Carolina, where they actually grow human organs. Believe it or not, they can take cells from your body and grow skin, cartilage, nose, bone, ears, heart valves, blood vessels, and now the human bladder. And within about 5 years, the first human liver and pancreas. Think of all the people who die because they're heavy drinkers, they destroy their liver, or they have diabetes. We're going to be able to cure these diseases in the future by simply growing new human organs.
You also talk about the quantum revolution, this idea of making materials with very strange properties, like them being invisible, for example, or creating things like the much heralded space elevator to launch things into outer space. Can you take us through a couple of those?
Sure. People don't realize that it is possible to make an object invisible, at least to microwave radiation. Think of water that goes downstream and wraps around a rock. If you're downstream of the rock, you don't know that there was a rock upstream because water has completely gone around it. In the same way, we can now bend microwave radiation around an object so that it becomes invisible to microwaves. Now, just recently in the last few months, we've been able to make progress with optical frequencies like red light and green light. And I suspect that within 10 years, we'll make an object completely disappear to red light or green light, and perhaps a little bit after that, to the full colors of the rainbow. And so invisibility, like Harry Potter, is not totally out of the question. We now have a theory of invisibility.
Well, one of my favorite things was your idea of a personal fabricator, this what I suppose Star Trek geeks might call their replicator. You go up to it, you say, I want a cup of tea, and it makes one for you.
That's right. The replicator is perhaps one of the most fantastic devices of Star Trek. And believe it or not, serious scientists at MIT have laid out a timescale by which we may be able to build a replicator, which, like a magician, can materialize something out of nothing. Now, that seems like science fiction until you realize that Mother Nature has already done this. Mother Nature can take hamburgers and French fries and turn it into a baby in just 9 months. Think about that, a personal fabricator of a human being in 9 months. Now, how does nature do that? With DNA molecules and with ribosomes that cut up protein cells, molecule for molecule, atom for atom, Mother Nature can create a baby in 9 months. So we know it's possible with atomic machines, and that's what we're doing in the laboratory. We're now trying to build machines made out of individual atoms, somewhat similar to the way DNA can create a human being.
Is a lot of this sort of predicated on better computers, artificial intelligence, that kind of thing? Or are we talking about a different method altogether of intelligently organizing things?
Well, first of all, what is driving a lot of these technologies in science and biology and medicine is the fact that computer power doubles every 18 months. That's called Moore's Law. Now, true robots are much more difficult, but we did go to Japan and we had a chance to meet with Asimo. Asimo is the size of a young boy, and it is the most realistic robot ever built. It walks just like a human being. It has rudimentary speech. And so we wanted the viewers to get a feeling of the fact that in the future, robot maids and butlers are still out of the picture, but it's conceivable that we'll have robots of increasing intelligence in the future.
I mean, the visions of future like the one you're painting have been sort of talked about ever since science fiction novels came along, and especially in the space age and in the 50s and things, we thought that we'd very soon be flying around in cars and wearing jumpsuits on Earth, and there would be colonies all over the place. And the spectacular number of those just never came true. I mean, how can we be confident that even at the pace of change that we are going through now, that some or all of these things that you're talking about will actually happen?
Okay, if you watch the early Jetsons cartoon, we're all going to have vacations on Venus, and we're going to talk to our personal maids and
butlers. It'll be hot in Venus, yeah.
Right. But if you think about it, all those predictions were made by science fiction writers. Scientists very rarely engage the public with their research, which is a shame because the scientists, of course, are horrified when people make these predictions and they never come true and people get disillusioned as a consequence. That's why in this program, for every single technology we profile, we talk to a scientist who's actually built it, built a prototype, or can conjecture what a prototype would look like. We want it to be grounded in the reality of what's happening in the laboratory, not the mind of a science fiction writer. Like 2001, we talked about starships going to Jupiter and beyond, and the movie talked about intelligent life in outer space and robots that we can talk to. But remember, Arthur C. Clarke is a science fiction writer, a very good science fiction writer, but we now know that 2001 was off, perhaps off by 100 years. It may be 100 years before we can have a ship of that size going to Jupiter. And that's why we went to the scientists themselves. They are the ones who are doing the yeoman's work, creating the architecture of the 21st century, and they have prototypes. In the program, you actually see prototypes of all these marvelous technologies that we've been talking about, so that within 10, 20 years, perhaps they'll begin to enter the marketplace and then change everything.
That was Michio Kaku. His series Visions of the Future continues on BBC4 tonight with a programme all about the biotech revolution. You'll find more details and a chance to discuss some of the ideas on our blog.
Hi folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Now then, we'll stick with the robots, but how's about we add a bubble perm and some tight leather trousers?
Knight Rider. A shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who does not exist.
calm down. They're not quite like Kit, the talking car and Knight Rider, but the best robot cars in the world did do battle last week in the final of the DARPA Urban Challenge in Victorville in California. The 11 competing vehicles had to negotiate a 60-mile course and all sorts of obstacles, all without a human being behind the wheel. Their tasks included on-road and off-road driving, avoiding the other robotic and non-robotic cars, and that old favourite, parallel parking. Well, Red Whittaker is the team leader at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute. They designed the winning car, nicknamed Boss. The big question, though, do automated cars make drivers lazy? Producer Ben asked Red that very question.
There's no need ever to turn the automation on. That's always by choice. So a human drives when a human chooses and sometimes selects an automatic feature when it makes sense. Cruise control is a good example. It doesn't make drivers worse drivers.
How long until I will be driving a car like Boss, or rather be driven by a car like Boss?
Automation features are introduced a bit at a time. That's why it's easy to buy automatic steering for a tractor, or automatic blade control for a bulldozer, or automatic cruise control for a car. It's always a step at a time, and every year there are more and more features like that. So it's not like the Big Bang creation of the universe, where one day you don't have automation and the next day everything is automated. Those features are demanded by the market, provided by the technology, produced by the companies, and get better over time. The next big one on the market is automatic stability control to prevent rollover, and anybody who cares about safety will care as much about that as about seat belts or baby seats.
Red Whittaker there, and didn't he sound like a happy chappy?
Are you all right? I took the liberty of scanning your vital signs. Your blood pressure is 190 over 120 and your pulse is 104.
Don't worry, Kit, it's the excitement of this podcast. Alok Jha here, you're still listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come...
My name is David Howard.
He doesn't sound very healthy at all. We speak to the scientist who's trying to make computers and robots sound more human. First, though, let's take a peek at the rest of the science and tech news from the past 7 days.
News Jack.
Scientists have taken a large step in understanding the workings of the so-called fat gene. The discovery will lead to a better understanding of why some people tend to put on weight more easily than others, and may offer the potential to develop drugs that could help. The gene is known to influence whether a person becomes obese, but until now no one knew what the gene actually did in the body, and therefore how it caused obesity.
Astronomers believe they have found a near twin to our solar system in a far-flung corner of the galaxy. A new planet is the fifth to be spotted orbiting a star that lies in the constellation of Cancer, 41 light-years away. Four of the planets in the 55 Cancri system are gas giants similar to Jupiter, while the innermost planet is believed to resemble Neptune.
When the eyes of two young lovers meet across a crowded room, it has little to do with romance and everything to do with sex and ego. Face researchers have found that smiling faces looking directly at us are much more attractive than the same face glancing to the side. The work challenges previous studies of facial attractiveness that have focused on physical characteristics, such as a preference for symmetrical faces.
And finally, a huge wild pig that can grow to more than 4 feet long has been discovered by scientists working in the central Amazonian rainforest. The monster hog, which has been classified as Peccary maximus, is twice as heavy as similar species living locally. And it probably tastes twice as delicious.
Bobby and James, thank you. Let's pick up on some of those. Ian, tell us a bit about the planets story, especially how it isn't actually a twin of Earth, as the Sun seems to think.
This was the discovery of a fifth planet, and put together that meant that obviously you had five in the solar system, and it has some similarities to our own solar system, but it's not a twin. I mean, there are lots of, it just means that everything else out there looks even less like ours. What was interesting is our own paper, kind of with its headline, suggested that this planet was similar to Earth. It's not. It's probably quite pretty similar to Saturn, if anything.
And then not like Earth then at all.
Not like Earth at all, no. I mean, it's massive, and it's like 45 times more massive than Earth, for example. And it's a ball of gas for a start. You couldn't stand on it. But then you have the Sun newspaper following that story up by actually launching a request among its readership to name what they're saying is the Earth's twin planet, because they don't like the name 55 Cancri-F, understandable.
Well, they're going to call it Vulcan or something.
Well, they said the Sun's already taken, and then they were quite keen. They made a really poor joke about a cup size.
All right, James, let's talk about love.
Go love, on. Lust at first sight.
Stop that. Don't look at me like that. Just talk about it. Look the other way.
I love it. Yeah, this is. To a certain extent, the science of the bleeding obvious, to be quite honest. But it's a nice little study on what it is about faces that makes them attractive. Now, in the past, people have looked at, as I said, physical characteristics like symmetry or masculine or feminine features.
Or beards.
Beards.
Like you.
Yeah. These guys look at something slightly different, which is the face that you're looking at, its attitude to you, if you see what I mean. So whether the face is looking at you, whether it's smiling, or whether the face is looking disgusted or to the side. And not surprisingly, if the face is looking at you and is smiling, then that's much more attractive.
I don't understand.
You and me, Kit, both. But seriously, is that it? Is there more to it than that?
Pretty much. I'm afraid. I mean, yeah, basically.
Excellent.
But it sort of tells you that, attraction is all about kind of ego. It's about, is this person interested in me?
Okay, well, Bobby, what about this story that you wrote last week about the fact there are so many bloggers in the world now out there? Four million in Britain alone.
Yeah, this was
pouring out bile and crap, probably.
Yeah, and go and visit our blog and tell us what you think about that.
I don't mean that.
This was on the back of a survey which just looked into people's internet use. It found that 44% of British people are using, or of British internet users, are surfing social networking websites. And they also found out that 15% of them claim to be actively blogging. I found the figures quite interesting. I didn't believe them, really, and surveys throw up all kinds of anomalies here, there and everywhere, but 4 million is obviously a huge number of people, and I certainly haven't seen 4 million blogs. But then I suppose actually when you branch out and you think, okay, if we think of blogging in the same way as the way you go to the science blog or other kind of blogs of that nature, I think a lot of people are actually now considering they're putting the same information out in Facebook and MySpace,
right.
and those they're blogging there, and so you can see this kind of mainstream adoption.
It's become much easier to do with Blogspot and all these other things. But what kinds of subjects are people talking about on these blogs?
Oh,
now?
Good God, everything under the sun.
I mean, this is a tool which sort of started off as a way for people to share information, scientific information, back in the web early web days. But now people are sharing cooking tips and all sorts. Aren't
well,
they?
I mean, it's a great thing. I mean, you went from the kind of early bloggers were technologists and people who were kind of interested in blogging just for its own sake and what the potential it might have. But now you've got people blogging about what they've had for breakfast in a good way. Go to londonreviewofbreakfast.blogspot.com. I love it. Or there are people blogging about their hobbies, surfing, drinking tea, all kinds of things. And all of these little communities.
How much is there to
say about drinking
tea? A surprising
amount.
Come on, we sustained, weeks, weeks with guests.
Let's not repeat that too soon. Oh, and also, Bobby, there's some new phone came out this week. Is that right?
Sorry, that one's passed me by. Oh, you mean the iPhone.
Is any good?
It's all right.
All right, guys, let's do some angry around listening. There's something that's made James very angry this week. But before we get there, Ian, why don't you set the scene for us? This is it's an interesting case of how science is dealt with in the media.
Yeah, so this story was really triggered by a front-page story on the Independent newspaper in the UK this week. It basically presented a report that came out in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which was looking at how overweight people do fare better in some diseases, with some diseases than others.
It was quite strong. It said being fat is good for you.
Yeah, the front page was now being fat is good for you. And then a radio station, Five Live, BBC's Five Live over here, had a big phone in that morning saying, what are scientists telling us? 1 minute being overweight is really bad for us. Next minute it's really good for us. And the whole story just sort of snowballed from there. I think the amount people actually learnt about what was going on in the story must have been absolutely minimal from all of that. The Independent story was actually okay, but the presentation, everything, the way the whole event went media-wise was a car crash.
So, James, start your angryometer now. What's got you riled about this?
Well, it's just a classic case, and we've talked about this before, of the media knocking down a media straw man of science. And, you know, I can see why scientists get really annoyed with this sort of thing, because the study itself is really interesting, and there is an element to it that is quite new and worth reporting, which is that if you're sort of slightly overweight, that's not a bad thing, and actually it's a good thing slightly, in that you have slightly better survival on the average overall. But, you know, what they said in the paper is overweight is not strongly associated with increased cancer or cardiovascular disease risk, but may be associated with improved survival during recovery from adverse conditions such as infections or medical procedures, and an improved prognosis for some diseases. So it's hardly, you know, being fat is good for you. You know, it's sort of a much more subtle message, which is that, you know, obviously being over massively overweight is really bad for you, but at this kind of slightly overweight stage, there are some aspects that are slightly better which might outweigh those.
But newspapers love a good headline, and the headline was quite arresting. And but in all of this, and with the discussion that happened on Five Live later, which I also heard a bit of, where you had people ringing in saying, why can't scientists just make up their own mind in private and let us know what their decision is?
Do we really want people to do that? I mean, it's absurd.
I spoke to a health psychologist last week, just after the World Cancer Research Forum published its huge meta-analysis, 7,000 studies they looked at to look at what causes cancer, and found that actually that lifestyle is a major influence on your cancer risk. So, and the famous phrase that came out of it was Michael Marmot saying, don't eat bacon sandwiches, you know, because they're terrible for you. And so with the context of that, there were people calling in to Five Live saying, well, you know, why is it that they're saying this on the one hand and the next week actually being fat's good for you? It's so confusing. It's terrible. These scientists are awful. And I think that ultimately who lost out in all of this? It was actually people just getting confused. It wasn't the media got their newspapers sold. The scientists will go off and carry on doing whatever they're doing anyway. But ultimately, you have lots of people out there just completely confused by the whole thing.
Oh, to be honest, I haven't got much sympathy for people who ring into Five Live, phone in, and say idiotic things like that. Because, I mean, you know, that's just the way science works. And you've got to have a slightly more sophisticated view of the world and work out, well, actually, sometimes you're going to have studies that, you know, contradict each other and, you know, things will come out in the wash. But, you know, the basic message is pretty clear.
Ian?
Well, I think what the nub of the problem here was that the media were saying, the reporters and the presenters were saying, okay, first of all, we were told being fat is bad for you. Now we're being told being fat is good for you. But this was the real flaw was they were treating disease as one thing, as a complete monolith. And what they weren't doing was saying it's good for some things and it's bad for other things. They wouldn't look beyond that sort of main, that top line to see what the details were. So the substance of the story was in the detail, but it really didn't come across. And I think that was the real sort of failing of the media.
The answer to all of this is only get your news from the science website, guardian.co.uk/science. And you can't say fairer than that, can you, Kit?
I hear you, Michael. Your comlink signal indicates you are locked in a hermetically sealed chamber, Michael. You have enough air for over 2 hours.
And what fetid air it is. By the way, stop calling me Michael. Now, we've been glancing into the future throughout this podcast, and we've also heard from Kit, the talking car there. Kit might have sounded very human, but the automated voices you hear on computerised public announcements and call centre messages just don't. Well, the development of vocal synthesis is on the up, and David Howard at York University is at the forefront of this research. He told our reporter Tristan Farrow about some of the advances he and his team hope to make in the next decade, and started off by showing off some of his new toys.
Well, I've got two things here. One is a electrolarynx. This is a little electronic buzzer which is used, for example, if you have to have your larynx removed through throat cancer, what do you do to speak? Well, you get a buzzer which sounds like this. And that buzz is what goes in at the larynx level as we speak. So I can put that on my own larynx and tell you what my name is.
My name is David Howard.
And you can hear that I'm moving my articulators around, moving the tongue and jaw around, but I'm letting the electronic larynx provide the input. So we get a sort of robotic, with a slight pitch change downwards, sound. Not a human being. And the reason for using this kind of stuff is it helps us understand what the contributions are of the larynx in the real system and the vocal tract in the real system. So we also have here some acrylic tubes, which are made of clear plastic, but they've been machined in the centre to have the same shapes as MRI imaging, that's magnetic resonance imaging, of real human adult male speakers. And if I plug my electrolarynx into the end of one of these tubes, we should get something which approximates the vowel R. I'm carrying two of these tubes. There's the vowel E, which has a different shape. It's much more constricted towards the mouth end, and it sounds like this. Now, why is this important? Well, what it demonstrates is that we understand how the tube shape change makes the sound change to get different vowels. We don't know anything about the resonances here. We've thrown that model away. We're simply using real tubes. Now, in the computer domain, we can make tubes virtually with a program. And that's what we've done. We've created a system that will synthesize vowels, similar to the ones you've just heard. But more importantly, it will allow us to dynamically change from one vowel to another. So for example, in language, the word I, E-Y-E or capital I, that is produced by starting with R and going to E. So if I do it slowly, I, and speed it up, I get I. For my model, we need to do the same thing. We need to start with the virtual shape for R and move it to the virtual shape for E without getting clicks and other artifacts which you typically would get if you start changing the shape of some virtual computer model. That's done. We've found a way of doing that. The rest of speech can follow reasonably quickly because the information we need to change the shape of the vocal tract is couched in phonetics. It's couched in what's been written about now for a very long time in terms of how human vocal tracts change. And speech therapists in hospitals do this all the time with people to help them regain their language after operations, after disease, or whatever else. So that information is in the literature.
Will computers be as good as Rory Bremner impersonating Tony Blair in, say, 10, 15 years?
In 10 to 15 years, yes, we will have machines around where people can create the sound of anybody saying whatever they want them to say. And what I'm specifically here to do is to encourage the young people who come to the talk to think about the social responsibility of scientists in my position working in this kind of area. What does it mean if we can simulate the voice of anyone saying anything and people can't tell the difference? Well, one thing is it could be your bank manager that rings you up and you give details of your accounts to somebody, but actually it's not your bank manager. It could be your loved one ringing up and it could actually be your mate having a joke and changing the date for the restaurant tonight. More seriously, it could be the leader of a nation. You could be synthesizing somebody saying something, and if you have the wherewithal to take over a communications network, you could then be broadcasting it to the people of a nation. I think it's important to be aware that the consequences of one's work may have good, but also evil possibilities. The good possibilities, I think, are legion, but one of the obvious ones is that if somebody loses their voice in the future, they would be able to get their own original voice back if this technology existed.
That was David Howard speaking with Tristan Farrow. And that, people, is your lot. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Bobby Johnson, Ian Sample, and, Kit.
I guess this is goodbye, Mark.
Stop calling me Michael. The genetics researcher, intensive care doctor, and occasional mountaineer, Hugh Montgomery, will be our special guest next week. He'll be telling us about the groundbreaking medical experiments he carried out at the summit of Everest earlier this year. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.